Blog Talk Radio.
Quiet, please. Welcome to Rex Sykes Movie Beat, Conversations with Filmmakers, where we discuss everything film and television. Here on Movie Beat, you'll learn what to do and what not to do when it comes to making movies and TV. We will talk to everyone behind the scenes and in front of the camera, and I'll provide you with the guests and the information you're going to want to have, whether you're a filmmaker or a fan. And so now let's move behind the scenes here at Movie Beat. First, let me tell you that my guest today, I'm very excited, is Mr. Gordon P. Firemark. He's an entertainment attorney, and he's going to be talking to us about the six different ways to fund or finance feature films. And so you're going to want to stay tuned for that. You're also going to want to reach out to other people, other filmmakers and friends, and you're going to want to get them to listen to us right now. If you're listening to this live, or whether you're listening to this as a recorded archive show, grab someone, email them, phone them, Twitter them, do whatever you need to do in order to get them to listen in too, because we're talking about financing movies. It's a hard thing to do these days, and Gordon's going to clarify it and give us the upsides and downsides of the different methods of financing feature films. So pay attention, listen up, and we'll begin in just a few moments. I'll tell you more about Gordon. But first, let me say that this is Rex Sykes Movie Beat. I'm your host, Rex Sykes. The official URL is RexSykes.com. That's my name, R-E-X-S-I-K-E-S. .com. And all of these interviews record live. You can listen right there from the website at the interviews blog, or you can listen to them 24/7 anytime from the interviews blog because they're all archived and stored right there. They're also available as podcasts from the iTunes store. Download them. There's over 300 hours of professional filmmakers sharing their expertise with you, secrets, tips, nuggets, advice, how to, what to do, what not to do in order to help you make your project smoother, faster, less expensively, to get it from idea to screen and for you to advance your career. So tune in and listen. And I got to tell you, there's an incredible library of filmmakers there. If you haven't heard all of the shows yet, subscribe to the podcast. It's absolutely free. Or visit the website and listen to them all in your leisure time or while you're driving or working or whatever it might do, as long as you drive safely, of course. Because it's literally, you know, a masterclass in a box kind of thing. It's right there at your fingertips. Directors, screenwriters, producers, casting directors, agents, cinematographers, editors, script supervisors, different people sharing their expertise for you. So be sure to go ahead and listen to all of that because you're going to want to. Now, one thing that I ask of you, one thing, maybe two things. One is share this. Share this right now with other people while you're listening live or archive. Tweet about it while you're listening. You know, if you like the comments or don't like the comments that I say and you like the comments that my guests say, go ahead and tweet about it and share it. Put it out on Facebook. Share it on your wall and other people's, you know, but spread the word far and near so that other people can stumble on it, find it. It increases our web presence whenever you help me promote my guests, okay? That's it. It'll increase our ranking and rating in the search engines, and it makes it more likely that filmmakers who could benefit from this information are going to find it. And your personal sharing means a great deal to me, and I appreciate it so much. Thanks for the love, and then right back to you. And the other thing is leave comments. Leave comments there at the player where you're listening. Leave them during the show or after the show, but don't go away without leaving a comment. It's right underneath the player. It's right underneath the chat window. It's right underneath the ads. Just go ahead and look for it. Depending on your browser, you'll see it. If it's not immediately visible right now, wait until the browser closes, and it will be. All right, and that's it. Share the site and leave comments. Rate and review them, the podcast at iTunes, and you help us get the word out. A very great deal, and I appreciate it so much. All right, without any further hesitation, let me tell you about my guest today, and then from there, I'm going to bring Gordon on. Gordon Firemark began his career working behind the scenes in film, television, and theater, and now as an entertainment attorney, that is still what he does. He said, as an attorney whose practice is devoted to the representation of clients in film, television, and theater, he helps producers, directors, writers, actors, and other industry professionals make deals that make sense and that get their productions developed, financed, produced, and distributed. His practice also covers intellectual property, cyberspace, new media, business, and corporate matters for clients in the entertainment industry. Now, as a producer and host of the Entertainment Law Update podcast, he provides a monthly roundup of news and commentary about the field of entertainment law for artists and professionals in the industry. Now, he also teaches producers, business people, and lawyers about entertainment legal issues at Loyola Marymount University, Southwestern Law School, and the Theater Producer Academy. Mr. Firemark holds a BA in radio, TV, and film from the University of Oregon, and he earned his law degree from Southwestern University School of Law. Before starting his own firm, he was a partner in the Business Affairs Group, and he worked in the legal and business affairs departments at Hanna-Barbera Productions and MGM United Artists Worldwide Television Group. He lives just outside of Los Angeles, his wife and two small children, a cat, and a mortgage. So help me now welcome Gordon Firemark to Rex Sykes Movies. Hi, Gordon. How you doing?
Great, Rex. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
And I'm excited to have you here. It's always really, really exciting and important to have someone like yourself, such as yourself, who understands the intricacies of the movie-making business, you know, because there's so many areas, from intellectual property and development and putting packages together and signing contracts and doing the paperwork and raising funds, that having someone, again, such as yourself, who can understand and shed light on these different aspects, to me, is fantastic, because there's just so much for us to try and wrap our heads around, and we can't do it. We need an attorney. We need the people who know how. So I'm very glad you're here.
I'm looking forward to sharing this information. I sure hope I can live up to that introduction. Thank you.
I'm sure you will. Well, let me say right off the bat, you're Gordon Firemark, and let's tell us where to find you on the internet so that people who can benefit from your services and or need to contact you in any way can find you.
Well, sure enough, it's my last name, Firemark. Firemark.com is my sort of hub of all things on the internet. For listeners on this show, they can go to firemark.com/Rex, and I have a bunch of different things you can sign up for, get some freebies, and learn some more about some of my products and services. But firemark.com is the base website, and on most of the social media sites, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and so on. My handle is G Firemark.
Well, that's very cool. And Gordon told me before the show just moments ago that he had put this site up. So if you go there, take a look at it. He's got great stuff how to negotiate better deals and different things that you're going to want to actually take a look at. So take advantage of that and go to firemark.com/Rex, right? And,
yep.
And that's what Gordon did all on his own, and I sure appreciate that for making it available to my listeners. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit background of you first in terms of, we read your bio, but as an attorney, you do so many different things in the film business. Let's hear right from you.
Well, for about 20 years now, I've been practicing this field, entertainment law, and the focus of my practice has been in sort of a split focus in live theater and independent film. And there's a lot of similarities in the way that film and theater are financed, especially in the low-budget film arena. It tends to be the investor financing model, and so the structures are similar, but the differences are significant enough that it's a little trick to sort of know where the boundaries are. Anyway, for about 20 years, I've been helping filmmakers and writers and producers, directors, and so on to get their stuff done, get their money together, get their projects through development and into production, and then out of the pipeline into the eyeballs of the viewers, I guess you could say. And that's what I love. The truth of it is, the joy of it for me is working in the production end of things and being on the other end of the line or there on the set when things are in production. But, the first thing you got to do when you get to get there is get the money together. And so I developed a bit of an expertise in how to go about doing just that.
Oh, that's very cool. Now, but let me ask you before we get into the different means of financing a feature film, the value of your services, of the position of a person in your position, in terms of you assist producers in packaging now and developing the projects and putting together.
I'm not an agent, so I don't help them shop around for studio deals and that kind of thing, but. When producers are putting together the package for the show, that's part of the financing, essentially, sort of the lead up to the raising the money is, assembling the talent team, assembling the business team, and getting your ducks in a row from a paperwork legal standpoint to be ready when somebody is prepared to either, write the check, put the funds into play for the film, or pick it up and produce it at the studio level.
So can we take a few moments and discuss that aspect of it? Because I think a lot of people aren't, they know they need money, but they don't know what they need to do before they get to raising funds, how they put stuff together, whether they need attachments or don't need attachments, or whether they need, what kind of package they need, a producer's package that they need to have for investors, and I'm sure it varies depending on where you go after the money. But can we address that area I'm a producer and a young producer, and I don't know exactly what I need to do first. What do I need to do first?
Well, the thing about it is to come at it sort of backwards and think about how are you going to get people to come and see your movie? And if you can show prospective financiers, whether that be an independent investor or a bank that's putting up funds or a studio or a distributor or however you're going about doing it, if you can show them that there's going to be audience interest in this movie, then they will be inclined to finance the project. And obviously, this is a bit of a gambling kind of a business where, the money goes in and sometimes the movie is a success. Well, you want to show them all of the reasons why your film is likely to be a success. And what that usually means in terms of packaging is having, some name talent attached to it name talent attached to it, whether that's the writer or the director or the producer or A-list talent on the project, that's going to get that interest level up. Audiences, for the most part, don't really care who wrote the thing, with a few exceptions. They care who's in it. Right. So, if you can get George Clooney and he says, yes, I'll do your movie, you're going to have a lot easier time financing it than if it's, Joe Sixpack from Peoria, Illinois, who may be a very talented actor. Right. But, audiences don't know him. It doesn't draw them in. It's his photo on the advertising doesn't do much for it other than show you an unfamiliar face. So that's part of packaging. Before you go there, though, in order to do that, you've got to have, in order to get that A-list talent, I should say, you've got to have some funds on hand or at least in the pipeline so you can, make the guarantees that the actor is going to want and so on. So it's a bit of a catch-22. You have to have the money to get the talent. You have to have the talent to get the money, et cetera, et cetera. Other things that you need to have in your package in order to get all that together, and this is one of those things where lightning has to strike in the same place several times, other things that you need is, first off the bat, make sure you've got your chain of title, the ownership of the material in place. So often these days I see a writer make a deal with a quote producer, somebody who may or may not have ever produced anything before, who's going to go out and shop the material around, and then if that shopping, leads to a lead, and someone's interested in the material, then they're both going to make their deal. And, that can work, but the producer's in an exposed, sort of vulnerable position of being at the whim of the writer and the financier who may or may not think much of that producer but likes the material, or vice versa. So getting the legal ducks in a row there and making sure you actually own the right to produce your film is a big one.
I'm so glad that you brought these points up, especially starting with the notion of starting backwards. I think that a lot of new filmmakers, and maybe even more experienced filmmakers, but I think so many people make the mistake that they think, I've got a movie and I'm going to make it, but they're not really sure what they're going to do with it. They think, well, maybe I can get it in DVD or I'll get it in theater, but they haven't thought it out. And a friend of mine, you know, Andrew Stevens, who made, you know, hundreds of movies, you know, always used to say, do your due diligence, start at the back end, just as you did. And as many other people say, and start at the back end, find out where your audience is, if you can sell the movie, who you're selling it to, so that you can interest the people you need to interest in making the film. And so, you know, right off the bat, I think that's a very valuable suggestion.
Rick, the real truth is that the job of producer, you know, anybody can pull together a crew and hire people to make the physical, you know, production happen of a movie or a play or whatever. The real job of the producer is a sales job. If you're, you know, you got to be a salesman from the get go. You got to sell, let's say you're going into one of those shopping days, you got to sell the writer on why you're going to be able to set it up and do something with it. You're going to have to sell those investors on the investment. You got to sell those A-list talent on doing this film, maybe even for less than they usually get for pay. You got to sell every single person who's involved in that project in one way or another. And all the way through to selling an audience on the idea of spending their hard-earned money on your movie as opposed to, you know, Harry Potter 27.
Right. No, excellent point again. And additionally, you also said, you know, the need for, you know, you're going to try and get a star or a name attached to a thing, and you need money in order to do that. That chicken and egg, the, you know, rock in a hard place, the catch 22 is prevalent. I mean, it's kind of like, how do people get it? You know, how do you get your SAG card without being in a movie? And you got to be in a movie in order to get your SAG card stuff. I mean, that is so catch 22. It's very prevalent in the movie business. So, how do you suggest then someone go about it? And one other question I should have before: do I need an LLC before I make my movie, or do I wait until I get finances? You know, I mean, is there an appropriate place or starting point? Because I know this is an area for some people. They run out and they start an LLC, and then nothing ever happens. They don't get their movie made, and they're sitting there with a company that nothing.
Yeah.
On the other hand, they don't have a company, and they want to get money. You know, are investors savvy enough to go, you know, these people are bright and smart, and if I'm going to put money in it, obviously there's going to have to be a bank account and everything set up. So,
mm-hmm. You know, the answer is yes, no, maybe.
Okay.
I generally recommend that folks don't spend a lot of money on forming entities and that kind of thing until they're pretty sure they know where their money is going to come from or how they're going about getting the money. They're going to need to form an entity at some point to be the production entity for the film and also to be the financing entity. The real trouble is that, you know, you're going to spend a couple of $1,000 to get that up and running and ready for everything. And the time I'd say to do that is really right as you're ready to go ask your investors for money. The trouble is, here in California at least, it is time-consuming to form an entity. You form an LLC, you send off some paperwork to the state Secretary of State, and they act on it, you know, sometime in the next 7 or 8 weeks, typically.
Right.
There are ways to make it happen a little faster at great expense, but, you know, it's a slow-moving government office, mainly just because of budget issues. So you do have to anticipate that a little bit. The other thing is that during that 7 or 8 weeks is the time that you're going to be putting together your financing materials. This is if you're doing an investor financed project. Some of the methods that we're going to talk about today for financing films, you don't really need an entity at all because you're essentially transferring the ownership and control of the project. And we'll get into that a little bit. But forming the entity, I'd say, is not until you've got the package sort of organized, at least, you know, a pretty good sense of what you're doing. You do need the company to be the contracting party when you get that letter of intent from the actor when you're buying the rights to the material. But that can be handled in paperwork once the company's up and running. An individual producer can, you know, buy an option without an entity. There's no problem there. So, yeah, as soon as you're going to be taking in investor money is really the time to have that entity in place.
Can and I want to get into the meat of this, but the letter of intent, can we clarify that? I mean, the letter of intent typically is as a letter of interest as opposed to a contract. I mean, so that people understand that when they get a letter of intent, no one's contractually obligated unless the producer has made some statement, correct? I mean, toward pay or
play. Right.
I was going to say, the actor is merely saying, I would be interested in doing it.
Yeah, it's essentially the actor, you know, who may or may be A-list talent, who normally gets paid, or you know, whether the movie happens or not, because they're holding themselves available for the project and whatnot. And so, oftentimes, before the financing is in place, what will happen is the producer will persuade the actor and his or her representatives to say, yes, I like the material. Assuming that I'm available and your financing comes through, I'm willing to do your movie. And on the strength of that, you can go out and say, hey, investors, you know, let's get the financing in place so I can sign them up. And oftentimes that gives you the added value of using that actor's name and photo in your promotional materials to try to get the financing in place.
Well, I've encountered young producers who say, I have so-and-so because they gave a letter of interest. And mm-hmm. unless the actor says, I will work no place else but for you during these dates at this time for X amount. I mean, in other words, it's not a contract. It doesn't obligate the actor to you in any way, shape, or form.
It's not particularly binding, no.
Right.
It is just that, a sales tool.
And is it wise to say, you know, in your package to the investor, you know, I'm going to get George Clooney. Look, and I hope George doesn't mind us using his name, but I'm going to get George Clooney. He's given me a letter of intent. And in the event that George is busy, I'm going to get somebody of his caliber, assuming they exist. I mean, you give the investor other choices, or you just say, I'm going to get George Clooney and that's it. I mean,
you know, I think that's a mixed bag, because then you're giving your sort of, it's cloudy to the uh-huh. reader of this proposal. If you say, I have a letter of intent from so-and-so and the investor's interested, telling them, and if he's not available, but I'll get somebody else like him, that undermines the strength of your argument, I think. I think that what's important is being very transparent of the fact that it's a letter of intent or a letter of interest, not I've already booked this person. Now, sophisticated investors are going to kind of understand that anyway, but not always clear to your average investor.
I have related to that point so the stronger your presentation is, in other words, the being transparent and being honest and being mm-hmm. upfront about everything, but the stronger you say, I have a letter of intent for George Clooney, the less cloudy, the less murky, the less muddied the waters, perhaps the better package, the better presentation you have to take to investors.
That's my gut, absolutely.
And can I ask this? Do you think people buy the package or they buy the person presenting the package? Go ahead. I was going to say, because the producer's a salesperson. I mean, they've got to be a salesperson. Is this the kind of thing, and I don't mean this to be a trick question at all. I'm just saying that it would seem to me that if somebody's savvy enough to invest money with somebody, that you know they're going to obviously look at the presentation, do you think there's a final tipping point with something? Go ahead.
I think the smart money is on investing in the person and rather than the package. Anybody can put together a nice, sexy package, and if people don't trust that person, ultimately when it comes down to, okay, I'm not giving money to a piece of paper, I'm giving money to a person who I'm putting in charge of it to try to make it turn into something bigger. So they've got to trust that person. They have to know and like and trust the person, and that's part of the sales process of being a producer, is building those relationships to the point where you can, you know, sell a product, sell yourself and your project to those investors. So there are always going to be the people who, you know, are blinded by, you know, the picture of the big A-list celebrities, who have signed letters of interest. But, really what it comes down to is the smart investor is going to look at the whole package. Sure, you know, does this person that I know, like, and trust have a plan that actually makes sense? But ultimately it's about the person. That's my take on it.
All right. Well, you've been very good about providing us, you know, with what we need to begin to think about when putting together our companies. And certainly there's so much more to talk about in that area, but I do want to get into the six ways to finance the feature film. And so let's begin with number one. What's number one way? Or the first way?
This list we're going to go through is you know, but it's somewhat comprehensive. But the thing to remember is that none of these single ways has to necessarily stand alone. There's the option to combine and mix and match within this list a little bit. The first way I want to talk about is the simplest, and we'll go from simplest to most complex. It is what I refer to as Rich Uncle Guido. This is where you use personal or family funds, you know, money you already have, essentially, that's given to use for the film without any recourse, without any quid pro quo. It's a gift of money. It's not an investment. There's really no expectation of a return or a profit. And obviously, that may be a hard sell for some people. But if you're doing a calling card film or a you know, resume reel kind of thing or some vanity project, you know, works great. You know, basically, Uncle Guido or mom and dad or whoever, you know, kick in the money and you go off and you make your movie. It's easy. It's sometimes there's no paperwork at all involved. It can just be, like I said, a gift. The cost of getting that money is negligible. No regulation. Essentially, it's your money. Someone gave it to you. You can do with it as you please. And the upside for the producer is fantastic, because if the movie does do well, does turn into something valuable, the producer's keeping all that money. The real downside of this is, A, it's not great if you're looking, unless you've got an Uncle Guido who's got $50 million to throw around, you're stuck in the low budget range of, you know, what can you really get from personal funds or family funds. There are oftentimes strings attached. Uncle Guido wants his girlfriend to be in the movie or something like that. If Uncle Guido does look like an investor, that is, if he has some involvement in the production, the control over the film, he may also have some liability if there are some accidents or injuries or you know, lawsuits that have to do with this film. Uncle Guido may find himself sucked into that lawsuit as well. And so that can be troubling. You have to be a little careful to shield them from that. And then,
Can I ask?
Of course, yeah.
I was just going to say, how are these Uncle Guidos protected? How are they shielded?
Two things come to mind. One is the protection by not having any involvement in the day-to-day operation of the company, of the production.
So they're silent, so they're not an active participant.
Yeah, not a partner.
They're not a producer. Yeah, they have no say. They just gave you money.
Exactly. And again, it was a gift, and now it's your money, and you're using it to do with it as you please. That's the best way to protect. If the person putting in that money is trying to influence the production by saying, I want my girlfriend to be in it, or, I want to see you change, you know, the second act, or those kinds of things, that's where they're likely to be exposed. And so the other approach to protecting against these kinds of things is to have some insurance in place. Insurance on micro-budget and low-budget films sometimes too costly to make financial sense. So again, you've got to, you know, make sure that financier is a good distance away by making it a gift or something like that.
Is one of the ways to protect this person to go, you know, I really want your money. Thank you for the gift. It's incredible. And he goes, yeah, I want my girlfriend in it. And you go, you know what, Uncle Guido, that would expose you. I mean, I'd just be upfront and tell him that, you know, if there was a problem, you would possibly face being sucked into some legal thing. And so as much as I'd like to put your girlfriend in it, you know.
Yeah.
I mean you got to be upfront with these. I mean, you can't, I mean, even family members, you don't want to lie to them or take their money in, right? I mean, how do you best talk to them?
I think just what you said, you know, you say, listen, you know, I'll take a look at so-and-so, and if she's talented, I'll put her in the movie. But, you know, if this is going to be a string attached to the project, then you need to understand that you may be viewed as a partner or a co-producer or something like that. And therefore, if there's a problem, you know, your name will be on the defendant line of the lawsuit as well. And, you know, that may take care of that issue. The one more downside that I want to mention in this
sure.
particular model is if the movie does do well and you've taken it and treated it as gift money and you don't, properly scratch the back of those who have scratched yours before, you may see some sour grapes coming out. You made a lot of money from that money I gave you to make your little resume movie, and I didn't get a penny from it. So you've got family relationships that you end up putting in jeopardy sometimes when you use this model, and there are ways around that, but something to be thinking about as well.
And that would be true, especially if you made money and or losing money if the person is expecting to make money on it. I wanted to
ask
you.
Well, if they're expecting to make money, then they're not. It's not a gift. It's an investment. And that takes us into the next model. So.
Well, but what I mean is that the unspoken is, I'll give you
yes.
the money, but in the back of their head, they're thinking, well, this thing is going to make money. They'll
yep.
return it. A true gift without any strings. It's not, I'm giving you money for your education, but now you have to, be a doctor. I'm giving you money
right.
for your education, be a poet or whatever you want to be, use it however you want.
Mm-hmm.
yes. Can I, let's say I'm the producer and I have mm-hmm. A dozen rich Uncle Guidos. Can I take like $50,000 from each Uncle Guido and have it be a gift? And then what does that do to me or my company or my taxes? Or, in other words, how does that actually work? Whether
Well, I am neither a tax lawyer nor an accountant, so I hesitate to give an answer, a definitive answer
on the tax question.
But my understanding is that, anybody is allowed to make a gift to someone else of a certain size, and I'm not sure what the amount is. I think it might be around $20,000 without having any tax exposure for either side of that equation. Gift money generally is not taxable to the recipient anyway. So that's actually why this can be a valuable thing. Can you take it from 5 or 6 or 10 rich uncles? Yes, absolutely. Again, as long as it's all gift so that you're not exposing yourself to, some of these other the concerns around securities law, around having investors under contracts and then them being exposed to liability and those kinds of things. Yes, it's possible.
Okay, and then just one further question. The likelihood, given that everybody's personal circumstances varies, if it's $20,000 and a person can gift someone in a year,
mm-hmm.
that's not taxed, then somebody might say, oh, sure, Rex, here's $20,000. It's a gift. Don't worry about it. It's not going to affect me. I've got the money to give. I'm not going to be taxed.
Yeah.
But if they said, here's $200,000, then they are liable for the taxes on that. I mean, that's part of their gift, is also paying the taxes on their gift.
Yeah, generally, yes.
So whether
they pay
or not
the taxes
somebody
on the money before they gift it, essentially.
Okay. All right. Well, very cool. And from here, you said that we go into the next step.
Yeah.
The
next model for financing a film is the single active investor approach. This is a very easy, simple contract in which.
I just want to make sure that I didn't move. Did you mention joint venture?
Well, we sort of talked about it without naming it. Joint venture is exactly that. Actually, we didn't. A joint venture is where, two or more people with some money get together to produce a film together. And we'll talk about co-production in a few minutes as well. And it's really, they're the chocolate and the vanilla swirl. So,
but it'd be Uncle
confident.
Guido, in other words, when you said that Uncle Guido, if he insists on putting his girlfriend in or wants some script changes, he now you could say, well, this is likely, you're going to be sucked into this, if the liability becomes a joint venture.
Yeah, this sort of crosses into the gray area of where we get into this active investor thing I'm about to talk about. But what I meant by a joint venture is you might see you raising some money and getting ready to make your movie, and I've got some money together and I want to make a movie about the same subject. So you and I come together and we both bring our family money and we partner up to make the movie. And that would be considered a joint venture or maybe a co-production depending on how we set up the business structure. But if we're both part of a team and working together on the creative and the business issues, then a joint venture is really a form of a partnership that's formed for a single limited purpose.
Okay, cool.
Okay, so on to the single active investor. As I said, it's an easy, simple contract where basically one or a very small group of investors contribute their money, this time with an expectation of receiving a return on that investment if the project is a commercially successful one. So the investor is essentially a partner in the project and has that personal financial liability that I was talking about for debts and overages and things like that.
Uh-huh.
And is entitled to actively participate in the management of the enterprise. That is, they're involved in a meaningful way in the day-to-day operations, the casting, the creative decisions, the business decisions around the project, and so on. And, of course, they do have that liability. So this is where a co-production, where there's a company coming in and putting its resources in and sort of taking some of that control, becoming a partner, it's like a joint venture where a company comes in or a couple of companies may come together and do their movie using their funds in this active investor model. It doesn't cost much to do this. As I said, it's a sort of a simple contract. The upside potential is great. You know, the producer's getting usually a proportional share of the revenues. The investor might get you know, half interest in the project if it's just one investor. And the great, you know, the big thing is there's no securities compliance required. The securities laws aren't implicated by these things because that investor is active and therefore can sort of protect him or herself by being involved in the production process. The downside for an active investor project is that that investor is active, is a partner. So you're sharing control and approvals and so on. And it's really not a great idea to have lots of these active investors because now you've diluted that control and you, the producer with the vision for the project, may have to take a vote on every casting decision or every location choice, you know, those kinds of things, who to hire as the director. And you can get bogged down in the administrivia of it all, the administrative trivia. So you really need to stay in the one or two investors on board kind of a thing. And, of course, the big downside for investors is that liability exposure.
Are there ways to – I mean, obviously there are ways, and that's again, why having an attorney on a project is essential. But in terms of the single investor, is there a way of having a simple clarifying contract? I mean, do you – that says these decisions will be made this way or that way. I mean, I suppose it's whatever anybody agrees to. You know, I say, Gordon, come on, let's make a movie, but I want to have my buddy John direct it, and that's my decision, and your capacity is in this other area, and as long as we all can agree on that. But does it make the most sense that since we're engaging in these kinds of decisions and engaging in these kinds of activities to have a representative, you know, draw up the paperwork for us so that when all is said and done, we're not spending the rest of our lives in court.
Or jail.
Jail. That's a good mention the jail point. That's a spooky one.
Well, it's important. You're walking a little bit of a tightrope when you do this active investor thing. If you make a contract that too narrowly circumscribes what the investor is allowed to do in terms of control and being active, it starts to look like they're passive. And passive investment is where you end up having securities regulations to contend with. I'll telegraph a little bit about what's coming later. The securities law is there to protect investors who don't have enough control over the project to protect themselves, to look after their own financial interests. And so the rule is, if you're selling a passive investment in which a person contributes money with an expectation of a return but doesn't have a meaningful level of control, then you have to register your securities, what you're selling, the interests, with the Securities Exchange Commission, or you have to find certain exemptions to operate under. So what you don't want to have happen is an investor comes in, let's say there's a lawsuit after the film is done, and the investor says, well, wait a minute, I wasn't really given any other control except approval of a budget one time, which is what a lot of producers try to do. But now this investor is being sued as a, quote, active investor, you know, with unlimited liability, and turns on you and says, hey, Mr. Producer, you should have registered this as a securities transaction. You violated the Federal Securities Act, and you need to give me all my money back, and I'm out. I'm done.
Ouch.
Or, hey, Mr. Producer, you didn't comply with the securities laws, and the federal authorities are coming to investigate, and you might end up going to jail for securities fraud. So that's the risk of too narrowly circumscribing the investor's role. So that is why you want to have a lawyer involved in creating this document. As I said, it's a relatively simple contract, but if you go too far in carving out, you know, the various parties' roles, you can find yourself on the wrong side of this issue.
And just so people understand again, you can go to jail. I mean, obviously, you have to be found guilty, but
yeah.
But it's that ignorance of the law is no excuse point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can go, I was well intentioned, I didn't mean to break the law, but you still, bottom line is, you broke the law.
Yeah. Well, you may stay out of jail, but you may end up having some kind of a settlement, or you may have, you know, some kind of a ruling against you that says,
right,
you know, go forth and do no more wrong. And by the way, don't ever sell any securities again. And now you want to make your next movie and you can't do it. You can't get involved in this kind of thing. And again, it's that know, like, and trust issue of, you know, people investing in the producer. If you go and you take money from an investor without telling them, oh, by the way, I was convicted of this thing a year ago or 5 years ago, that's a problem. That's fraud. And I think that's a material fact that investors need to know about the people they're investing with. So
is it fraud? Or let's say somebody was, you know, they did something in their 20s or their teens or something, you know, they got a criminal record, but now, you know, I mean, I'm trying to come up with a scenario, but now,
yeah,
you know, they're 40 years old, they've never been convicted of another crime. Do they have to disclose the fact that, you know, they were convicted of a felony or something when they were 20? Is that within the same purview of fraud and disclosure for investors?
I would say it depends on the felony. If the felony is related to the handling of financial matters, or you know, is a crime of dishonesty, as opposed to, you know, I got caught smoking dope with my friends and we got arrested,
right,
and charged, and you know, and I was 20 and now I'm 45 and I've had a clean record ever since then. That's probably not really relevant to an investor's decision. I mean, there may be some investors who would say it is. But if you were convicted of embezzlement or theft or, you know, something like that's relevant. And if I'm an investor and I don't have the opportunity to know that about you before I write my check and I later find out about it, I'm going to be pretty justified in complaining that you didn't give me all of the material information that I needed in order to make an informed investment decision about this. So...
you know, Gordon, I didn't want to interrupt you. I'm going to have to take a break. I want to let you finish your thought because I don't want to stop you in midstream. But before we come back to the next number of it, of structured opportunities, so go ahead, and then I want to take a break.
Okay. Well, I was just going to say that, you know, this issue of disclosure of your past and your record and stuff is less of a concern in the rich Uncle Guido and the single active investor scenario because, again, the investors have the opportunity to really protect themselves. And in the next couple of things we're going to talk about, which involve the studio, again, studios are sophisticated, you know, financial operations, and they can protect themselves. It really becomes an issue when we get into the securities offering, registered or exempt securities deals. So we'll come back to that in a few minutes.
Fantastic. You are listening to Mr. Gordon P. Firemark, entertainment attorney and producer, talk about the 6 ways to fund your feature film. We got a lot more show coming and a lot more to talk about. I can already tell that Gordon and I are going to do multiple shows on this because we're going to be running out of time here, Gordon. But, no, this is absolutely fascinating. And you're listening to Gordon. His website is firemark.com. That's FIREMARK.com. He's also on Facebook. You're also on Twitter. Do you want to give your Twitter address out?
It's G Firemark.
GFiremark at Twitter. All right, so here's where we are at the show. I'm going to tell you about my upcoming guests. Please leave comments. Feel free to live tweet, share the website, share this information with other people, whether you're listening live or archived. If you're listening live or you're joining us for the first time, come on in the chat room and join us there. If you're listening to this archived, keep in mind that there are hundreds of other fabulous interviews that you're going to want to listen to about filmmaking and movie making and TV production. All right, so my next guest on May 1st is John Savage, actor John Savage, known from The Deer Hunter and from Hair and from so many other movies and movies and TV. He's got almost 200 credits. He'll be joining us on Tuesday, May 1st. Rex Piano is a director. He's been on the show a couple times before. He's going to be returning on the 3rd of May. And you're going to want to listen to him. He's done a lot of television movies, particularly we're going to talk about TV, continue our discussion on TV movie production. Clint Howard is supposed to be with us on the 8th. Don't know if that's happening yet. Got to get back in touch with Clint to make sure that the date is open for him. He's busy, you know, making movies. So Nicholas Tabrock is a prolific producer, made many, many movies since the 90s. He'll be joining us on Wednesday the 9th. Kim Swanson is a casting director out of Missouri. I like to say Missouri. I don't know how you say it, but I like to say Missouri. She's going to talk to us about, you know, making a career as an actor when you aren't in Hollywood. And Peter Foley is going to come up on the 22nd. Now, there are other actors and other filmmakers in between, but I'm going to tell you, Peter Foley is a producer and musician and a director, and he's going to be joining us there as well. As far as that goes, I don't know, and Sam Christensen is coming back. I have the date for Sam, but I don't have it at my fingertips. So we'll be talking to Sam. Oh, Monday the 7th. I'm sorry. Sam is on Monday the 7th of May. All right, well, there you have it. You're listening to Rex Sikes Movie Beat. The official URL is rexsikes.com, and we're live with Mr. Gordon Firemark. And we're discussing now the studio setup in terms of raising money for your feature film.
Yeah, the third of the six ways that you can finance a film project is the deceptively simple conceptually and extraordinarily complicated in practice is setting up your project with a studio for production at the studio in-house. You know, obviously the studio has the money and other resources that can make this movie happen, probably on a bigger scale than an independent producer is going to be able to do. They have, you know, the resources to distribute the film, to market it, to promote the heck out of it, to take it to all the festivals, you know, all those kinds of things, which means, you know, better chances of box office success and so on. What you're doing is essentially selling the project, the package that you've put together, to the studio. The studio takes it over. They own it. They give you credit. They give you a fee as compensation for your services, you know, your producer fee. And you know, and they essentially take over the project in terms of producing. You may retain some degree of authority and responsibility over the production, the creative and business choices. But you know, as often as not, the studio is going to be able to overrule you on any of those issues that you come up with. And that's one of the issues that gets negotiated in these deals is you know, where are the power boundaries going to lie? One great advantage of this is that you get your money pretty early. You're getting paid that fee. You're getting paid, usually, you know, reimbursed for the expenses you've incurred in packaging the project. So you get your money out as a producer. And another advantage is that, you know, in higher budget films, the producer's fees tend to be higher than you would get on the budget of an independent film. The downside, several downsides, it's really hard to get a studio to buy your film and take it over like this. You know, for every script that's picked up this way, there are dozens, maybe hundreds, that just languish around town for years and years and years, never getting picked up, never getting any, you know, real traction. And so the producer who's got these projects in his pocket may find himself very frustrated trying to focus on this studio approach. Also, sometimes the producer is actually a liability to the project because the studio has to, same issue as the investor, the studio has to know, like, and trust you, the producer, as well as love the material and think it's marketable and commercial enough for them to do. And that's true of everybody involved in the package. You know, the studio may love the script but hate the director that you've signed on, so you've got to be cautious about packaging, I guess, about tying it up too tightly when you make the package. So that's the model of selling it to the studio and just letting them take it and do it in-house. The studio becomes the owner. They control it from start to finish through distribution. And one of the other risks here is that, you know, a studio executive who loves the project buys it, pays you out, you know, reimburses you your out-of-pocket stuff, or sometimes only a portion of your out-of-pocket, and then gets fired or quits. And now you've got regime change at the studio, and the new guy comes in and doesn't want to be, you know, a yes man to the person who held his job last month. So a lot of the projects will sit on the shelf and may never get finished unless you, the producer, can now persuade that executive who already owns it and doesn't have any skin in the game, essentially, because they haven't expended any of their political or financial capital to get that project. You know, do you like it? Can you make them like it enough to keep going with the project and get it made? So there you go.
And this again, though, is where you'd want to have someone negotiate a right to revert the rights back to you after a certain period of time and make sure that all your I's and T's are crossed.
Yeah, a turnaround provision or a reversion clause in the contract would be, you know, a smart choice there. Not always possible to do with a studio setup. The studio is, after all, in the business of acquiring assets and may not be inclined to let you have it back, even if you're paying them, you know, their cost plus interest. They may also be buying the project for reasons that you can't anticipate. For example, they also have a project on the same subject matter already in development, and they don't want your piece out in the marketplace to compete with it, so they'll put it on the shelf deliberately.
They're taking you out of play. Well, so if it comes to a studio deal, then like I say, I have my pet baby screenplay, and I'm a young, you know, aggressive guy. I want to direct my own movie, and it's, you know, there's nothing better than it in the whole world, according to me. And I go to the studio, and they go, "Yep, you know, we'll buy it." Mm-hmm. I got a choice. I mean, I got probably lots of choices, but I got a choice to think. Okay, they're not going to let me direct it. My name may or may not end up on the written by, right? Because after it's written a number of times, I mean, that could lose my whole credit to the thing. They might just buy it and shelve it because some guy leaves, or they're deliberately buying it to shelve it with no intention to purchase it. So I gotta sit down and go, cash or I keep it. You know, I mean, in other words, if I'm willing to take the cash and go, you know what, this is at least going to finance me and feed me and my kids for a while or allow me to make a different picture, then, you know, hey, I'm ahead of the game. I sold a script.
Yeah, and you might get some kind of credit. And, you know, there's value in having set up a deal at a studio, even if they don't make the movie, because now you've got an open, you know, a door to open when your next project is looking good. And, you know, I think there are a lot of producers around who have, you know, set up a lot of projects without having gotten them made before the first one gets made. And then now if you get, and especially if it's a successful film, now you go back and you say, well, you've got this catalog of other stuff that we've set up over the years. Let's look at what's here and see what we can turn into something big. And, you know, you may have had, you know, a B-plus list actor attached to one of those projects back then, but now you are a hot shot producer. Maybe now you can get your A-plus actor to sign on. And all of a sudden a, you know, modestly attractive package becomes a hot property. So, yeah, there's a lot more than just the money or just the credit to consider in these situations.
Well, that's a very interesting notion because, I mean, I talked with Sam Christensen yesterday, who I've known for many, many years, and Sam's been in a variety of positions. And Clooney is somebody that I know through, you know, his family and everything else. And anyway, and we were talking about how George had done, you know, tons of pilots without ever being seen, you know, and none of them aired. And then finally, you know, he got ER, you know, and he's become a star. And Sam's point was
20-year overnight success.
Exactly, which is the case for many people in L.A., or probably most people in L.A. And but the point that Sam and I both made, you know, he worked incredibly hard to get there, but all the while, you know, that he was unaired, I guess you would call it. You know, he made all these pilots. You know, he was collecting money. He was living a good life. He just wasn't a star yet, but he was a working actor. So what you just said, I think, is really appealing. If you're lucky enough to sell a screenplay and open the door to the studios, you could literally be an unproduced producer or writer for many, many years and still have sold a number of projects to the studio and at some point then become hot, as you say, because you have a catalog of former, you know, projects that were sold that now somehow gets greenlit. So, yeah. I mean, what I like about what you're proposing is that, or at least the way I think about it, is you got to look at the big picture, not the single sale all the time.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, listen to your advisors, your agent, your manager, your lawyer, your family. Everybody should, you know, chime in when it's decision time on some of these kinds of things. The fact of it is, Hollywood is full, hundreds, maybe thousands of people in this town who you've never heard of. You know, they're writers or directors, whatever. You've never heard of them, but they've supported their family in the movie business for years, decades, you know. And there's no shame in that. In fact, I'd say that's fantastic. You're doing what you love. And, you know, granted, it's that sales part of it rather than the getting out and exposing the frames of film. But, you know, that's the dream, really, is to write for a living or direct for a living or put packages together for a living and something to think about.
That is, I mean, that's an excellent point. Just an absolutely excellent, excellent point. So I appreciate that. Now, I should say that we have literally about, on the outside, we've got maybe 25 minutes left in today's show at the very outside. So I can tell that we're going to be talking about this in another show. and I just want the listeners to know that you and I are going to find a date and then have you come back. But and I also want to say that Gordon has got some great stuff available for you if you go to firemark.com/Rex. He's made this available to listeners of the show. So if you're listening today live or archived, go to firemark.com/Rex and look at the things that are there for you and to benefit you. All right. So I'm...
Let's rip through the rest of these six. We've covered the first, three of them. We'll cover them all quickly, but we may end up coming back and leaving a lot of open questions about number six, which is, I think, the big one for a lot of people. So,
yeah, sure, So
let's jump in. Number four is a variation on the studio setup. It's what's called a PFD deal, Production, Finance, and Distribution deal. Essentially, in this structure, the studio is agreeing to finance the production with you as the producer. They will have some oversight, but not to the same degree as if they bought the project outright from you. They typically do dictate most of the key elements and personnel and so on, and they have takeover rights if things are getting out of control, going over budget, getting behind time, those kinds of things. And they do ultimately get the right to distribute the project. They end up essentially owning it after it's made. You receive your credit, your compensation, and a higher degree of control than under the typical studio in-house deal. And this is a way that many sort of major independents are financed these days or have been financed historically. Again, very, very difficult to get this kind of a deal set up unless you've got a beautiful package and some clout as a producer to hold on to some of that control. But sort of the holy grail in Hollywood is one of these two studio models. I submit that it's not always the best approach because you give up a lot of control and so on. It can be tricky to set up. The deals often involve, you know, multi-picture deals and housekeeping arrangements with the producer, and the profit participation scenarios can be really complicated. And so you really need help negotiating this kind of a deal with someone who's got some experience and knowledge and also intuition about how things should operate in this scenario. Let's move on to the next one.
Well, let me just ask you a quick question. Okay. I know we're speeding up, but how does one differentiate between the PFD deal and a typical studio deal? How do I know where I'm at? I mean, somebody comes to me and says, okay, we're going to do a PFD, or, I mean, does my question make sense?
Yeah. It can be really hard to distinguish when you're on the receiving end of the offer to distinguish. I would say that if it's your first deal out, it's not a PFD deal. They're buying the material from you, and they're basically saying, here's some cash and a credit. Thank you. We'll call you when it's time for the premiere. A PFD is going to look much more like, okay, we're the studio. We like this project. We're going to put up the money. and we're going to monitor things every step of the way, and we're going to chime in with our opinions, we're going to chime in with our commands, but it's your movie to go make. You deliver it to us, and then we will distribute it. So that's really the distinction. The PFD, the studio, is giving you access to its resources, access to its funding, and access to its distribution, of course, but it's still on you, the producer, to make the movie.
I'm just going to ask you a further question, and I'm going to utilize somebody who has said this in public, so I'm not saying anything that he didn't already say, at least allegedly. Kevin Smith, for example, started as an independent filmmaker and has said, you know, I've never made an independent film since Clerks, essentially. They've been studio movies, you know, because they... without saying we know Kevin or not, I mean, you know, or the intricacies of that, what's likely going on there? Is he no longer, I mean, he's now in a PFD deal. Is that where he stands?
That would be my guess. I don't know Kevin's deals, but that would be my guess that it's PFD, or he may have a house key. I don't know. Is he set up with one particular studio that he makes them all for now?
That could be. I don't recall off the top of my head. So he may have.
Yeah, so that's going to be some kind of a housekeeping deal where he is given some office space and access to the studio's relationships and catalog of library material and so on, as well as access to funding and so on. And, you know, he probably has to give them a first look at everything he does or everything he plans to do and let them green light it before he's able to go do it somewhere else, something like that.
Right. And we just don't know, but that's good. I mean, that's cool. All right, so, and then moving on.
Yeah, the negative pickup deal. You know, in the 80s and 90s, this is the way movies, lots of independent movies, were financed. It's one of the more complex approaches. In fact, I'd say it's maybe even the most complex, but number six I left to the end for a reason. So number five, the negative pickup deal, is essentially this. You borrow the money from a bank to make the movie. Now, the bank isn't going to lend that money to you without some collateral. And what they're looking for as collateral, in addition to the right to take over and own the film itself and the elements, is that you have some distribution agreements to put up as collateral. So you need a contract with a distributor or a number of distributors. Excuse me. So you've pre-sold them the film, again, on the basis of your package, on the basis of your salesmanship. And on the basis of those pre-sale contracts, a contract that says, if you deliver a film that meets these criteria, by this date, we will pay you X dollars. On the basis of those kinds of contracts, the bank is lending you money to make the movie. Now, they're not going to lend you. Let's say those contracts add up to $10 million worth of distribution fees, distribution advances, I should say. The bank's not going to lend you $10 million. They're going to lend you, you know, $9 million. And so you've got to make the movie for $9 million or find a way to bridge the gap. And now we get into something very complex called gap financing, which uses a complicated insurance scheme as well as, you know, completion bonds and these contracts as collateral and all of that. It's much too complex to really get into here. Just suffice it to say, this is bank funding, bank financing of the film on the basis of that future promise to pay when you deliver. Now, of course, the bank is very concerned that you are actually going to be able to deliver the film on time, on budget, you know, and meeting the various criteria. So they're going to insist on a completion bond. What a completion bond is essentially an insurance policy, a promise by the bond company that says, okay, Mr. Bank, I'm going to give you the assurance that if the producer's going over budget, screwing up, not getting it done, we're going to take over the film and finish it so that there's something to show for it at the end, and we can deliver it to the distributors, who will then pay the money to pay back the loan. Completion bond is an expensive component of these things. Many independent, single active investors, for example, will look for a completion bond as part of the package as well in order to, have some assurance that they're going to get at least have a chance of a return on their investment. So that's the negative pickup deal. The upside is you're making your movie your way. No studio looking over your shoulder. The distributors are, you know, looking over your shoulder in the sense that they've established some criteria that you have to meet. But, you know, as long as you make that film, deliver it in a timely fashion with the elements you promised, you receive the money to repay the loans and make your movie. distribution is locked up in advance, so there's fewer worries once you finish and deliver the film. And once the bank has paid off, you get the profits. You don't have to share it with investors and financiers and so on. It's yours. Really, really complex deals. Sometimes as many as sort of, you know, 7 or 8 or 10 different contracts involved in making this happen, not counting those distribution agreements that have to be in place. Hard to get these kinds of deals these days. The negative pickup is not exactly a thing of the past, but a thing of the, well, it's just increasingly rare. The banks and lenders are shying away from these kinds of very risky investments, even with those bonds and even with the insurance and things in place. So, you know, there you go. You got to have an extraordinarily compelling distribution, a package for the distributors to get interested and buy. I mean, you go to the film markets these days, and the buyers, the distributors and the distributor reps, tend to be looking more at films that are already in the can and less likely to make promises about films that aren't done yet on the basis of a one sheet or a proposal or, you know, script and those kinds of things. What they often will say is, sure, bring it back to us when it's in the can. So you're stuck in that catch-22. I can't make the movie until I have distribution in place. Can't get the money until, you know, I can't get the distribution until I have the money and have actually made the movie. One other disadvantage is the cost of these bank loans. It can be pretty expensive. They're lending, again, you know, on a less than dollar-for-dollar basis. They're discounting the value of things. And then you have the cost of the gap insurance and the completion bond and all of those costs plus interest on the loan. So there you go. And, of course, if you go over budget, you can lose control. The bond company will come in. So that's the negative pickup deal. Next up.
I'll let you go ahead. I was going to say that because the time is running slow, we'll go to the next one. And I'm going to have you back, and I'll talk to you after the show about getting back. We'll talk about the new advantages in the next show. But I'm sure we're going to have a lot of questions, maybe from listeners or people who are today in the chat room, or those people who will listen to it between then and now. I certainly have other questions to ask you, we'll get through this and then come back and ask the questions. So this is absolutely fascinating, and. Of these six, and we haven't gotten six one yet, we'd say like the negative pickup deal is increasingly rare. Going back through them, apart from Uncle Guido, although given the economic climate of today, are these also in terms of they're harder to do, so they're less likely to come by, or is the sixth way we're going to talk about still mostly the prevalent way that people get their film financed, and is it the studio setup, or how are things in today's economic climate for filmmakers? What do you see, a particular deal one over the other happening?
In this economic climate, what I'm seeing is a shrinking of the availability of funds for films generally. The banks aren't lending as much as they used to and as often as they used to. Investors aren't investing as often as they used to. Even studios are being more cautious and careful about how they expend their resources in making movies. So you're seeing, I think we're seeing fewer high-budget movies and fewer movies being independently made, for sure. There's just less risk-taking going on, I guess you could say. The banks have stopped lending, because the banking business over the last 5 years or so, in particular, has been really unstable. And so I think the banks are being really cautious about this kind of thing. And a lot of the money for these bank loans was coming from European banks, and European banking industry is feeling the pinch that we were feeling a few years back. They're lagging us a little bit, so I think it's going to be a while before the banks come back into play in this way, in a meaningful way.
Go ahead. No,
I was going to say the pre-sale model is something that we also see with investor financing, because of course if you've got a pre-sold distribution, even just one or two territories, investors are going to be more interested in the package. So that pre-sale of the of the distribution can be part of your packaging as well as part of the financing.
And I want to talk to you about that too. So let's go into the number six, because the pre-sale notion, if that's still possible, if, you know, if I can take my package and go to distributors and they say, yeah, you know, we would pick that up. I mean, so but let's get through number six here, because this is this is the big one too.
Well, we'll paint the big picture on number six. I don't know that we're going to get through all the nitty-gritty of it, but number six is the investor financing, where essentially you prepare a business plan for the film, you prepare an offering document, and you offer investors the opportunity to buy essentially shares of equity in the project. So they become co-owners of the project, investing without having any active involvement. You know, once they sign the check on the strength of your offering materials, the business plan and private placement documents and so on, once they've written that check, they don't have any more decision-making authority over how the film gets made. So they're passive, and that's what I was saying earlier. Once you get into passive investment structures, that's when you have to comply with the federal and state securities laws in each state where an investor resides. So the basic rule is this. If you're selling a passive investment, you have to register it with the SEC and with the state authorities in every state where an investor resides, unless there is an exemption available for your particular project. And there's a handful of exemptions. The most common ones fall under what's called Regulation D, under the Securities Exchange Commission's rules. And this basically puts some limits on how you go about getting that money. It has to be a small or limited offering of different exemptions for different sizes. There's an under 1 million range, there's an under 5 million range, and then there's an any amount, but only to certain kinds of investors. That is people who are called accredited investors. They have a high net worth, they're sophisticated in investment decision-making, and can sort of look out for themselves. And the investment then is not registered. It's just, filed with the SEC after the fact, as a just matter of sort of record keeping. The basic rules, as I said, is the number of people that you can approach about the investment and the kinds of people you can approach and how much money you're going to raise can be limited. So this is the investment scheme. And the way it usually works is the investors share in, on a proportional basis to how much they invested, half of the net profit of the film. So let's use $1 million budget as a model. Typically what happens is the investors will come in with their $1 million toward the $1 million budget of the movie. The producer goes and makes the movie and then starts receiving money in from distribution and other forms of exploitation. Every one of those dollars that comes in goes back to the investors first until they've broken even on their investment, what we call recoupment, or sometimes we define that as a little more than broken even, maybe 110% of their initial investment. Then, once that has happened, the producer and the investor share equally in the profits that have come in from the film. So before that recoupment has happened, you're not in profit. It's just gross receipts coming in and paying back the investment. And then once you've made back that investment, you're into profit, and that's 50-50 between the investors and the producer. That's a typical deal. The percentages sometimes shift a little bit. It might be 60-40 in the favor of the investor. If the investors are putting up less than the full budget of the movie because the producer's got some resources or something else, then it might shift in the other direction. But that's the investment financing structure. And we can get into the real nitty-gritty of what needs to be in that business plan and offering circular in our next conversation. Suffice to say that this is a very complex technical document that needs to be prepared for each individual film. There's a lot of, can I find a form on the internet kind of thing going on out there, and I would caution against that because each project is a little different, and the climate changes from week to week in this business. So,
well, there's an aspect to this, too, that I know you list as disadvantages, is the idea of no general solicitation. Now, can I ask? I think a lot of people, you know, they're ambitious. They go on Craigslist and they go, I want investors for my film and, you know, contact me here, or they put an ad in the paper, or they go to some networking function at you know, some entrepreneurial kind of meeting, and they go, oh, I have an announcement, I'm making a movie, anybody want to talk to me about making movies, you know, come on over, you know, you might be able to, you know, finance my film. These are areas that are dangerous, maybe?
Yeah. You know, up until a week or two ago, I would have said to anybody who went online, actually, one of my first clients was somebody that it was in a forum on the AOL service back in the early 90s, and they went online and they put a posting saying, we're raising, you know, I don't remember how much they were looking for their film, you know, contact us and we'll send you a proposal. And right there, my response to them was, hey, you guys just blew it. Now you can't do an investor finance deal under these exemptions because you made a general advertisement of your offering, a general solicitation. The rules used to be and have been for a number of years, since the 60s, a limit on the number of people you can approach. And therefore, you couldn't go out and make a general solicitation. It had to be people you already knew and had relationships with. And so the game was to establish and build those relationships early enough that you could then approach people about the money, or bring on people who had those relationships with people that had money and make them co-producers or executive producers and things like that. Two or three weeks ago, the president signed the Jobs Act, the Jumpstart our Business Startups was the name of the act. And that law, when passed, changed the rules a little bit. Now, the regulations have to still be made by the SEC, but it has lifted that prohibition on general advertising and solicitation for certain kinds of these offerings. Generally, when you're only approaching and only taking investment from these accredited investors, people with a high net worth that I was talking about. So this is the crowdfunding change to the rules. So what we're going to see, it's not in place yet, and I wouldn't counsel anybody to go out tomorrow and put up their ad on Craigslist, but coming down the pipe in a few months, we will see the SEC issuing regulations that change the rules a little bit and give us a little flexibility in terms of these general solicitations. Where you could put up on your webpage, hey, contact us if you're interested in investing, or something like that. There are going to be a lot of limitations on how that's done. Many of them will have to go through an intermediary that is registered with the government. So you'll see, you know, the Indiegogos and Kickstarters and those kinds of companies having to register as a broker dealer or a funding portal and jump through some hoops there. And another thing that this will work nicely for films and projects of under about $500,000. Once you get over $500,000, the rules are going to require audited financial statements. And for a new company without any really track record, that's going to be pretty hard to live up to. I mean, the audit might not be very expensive because the accountant says it's a brand new company. There's nothing to audit. And I don't know whether the SEC is going to go for that. So we have to watch and learn. The rules are supposed to come out in 90 days for one component of it and 270 days for another component. So we'll be watching this for the next year or so. But crowdfunding is going to become a reality, at least for certain kinds of film projects.
That's exciting news, and we are at the end of our time almost. But that is really exciting news. Now, is there a difference in understanding, you know, when we were talking about, you know, the securities and investor financing, this number six way, so just so that we're clear, if it happens that they relax the rules and they make general solicitation more, I guess, more liberal, I don't know how else to say it. Is there a difference between what crowdfunding? I mean, crowdfunding is at this point not an SEC governed thing, right? Because people are donating; they're not investing in a
crowdfunding. That's the old version of crowdfunding.
Crowdfunding is no longer. Oh no, this will be very fascinating. Yes.
Okay. So here's the thing: crowdfunding used to be operating outside the rules of the securities laws because there was no quid pro quo. There's no return on investment. What this relaxation of the rules is going to do is make it possible for a company that's trying to raise money to offer a quid pro quo, a return on investment. And so the portals, the crowdfunding portals, if they want to do have the option of doing these, you know, for profit, for, you know, in exchange for a return, they will be able to if they register with the SEC and jump through the various hoops that are going to be set up through the regulations. So that's it's a hugely exciting thing, because now you can go on Indiegogo and you can still raise $50,000 to do your little resume movie without having to pay anybody back. Or you can go raise $500,000 to do, you know, a low-budget independent film or a web series or something like that, and you know, have high production values, because the people who put up that $500,000 might be expecting to see some return on their investment. Now, there are also going to be a bunch of rules about how those investors have to qualify and how much percentage of their annual income they're allowed to invest in any given year. And so there'll be caps and rules about that kind of thing. It wouldn't surprise me to see the investors having to register and provide some information to these portals as well.
Wow, fantastic news and fantastic information and a fantastic guest. And listeners, that's why you want to discuss things with an attorney who knows what's happening, so that they can clarify it for someone like myself who doesn't have a clue what's going on 90% of the time. I appreciate
Rich,
that.
Let me just say right now, even we attorneys, I mean, even the folks who wrote these laws don't exactly know where the lines are going to be drawn. So
right.
It's just a little too soon for us to be really giving a lot of legal advice about this crowdfunding. But I would say by the end of the year, we will definitely be positioned to advise about this kind of thing and move forward with crowdfunding and these offerings with general solicitations.
All right. Well, there you have it. Gordon, I thank you so much for being here. We're going to come back with Gordon another time, hopefully sooner rather than later. I want to talk to you about that just as soon as we get off the air. But a fabulous wealth of information. I hope you will share it with all of your friends, all of your industry contacts. I hope you post it, you know, near and far, that what Gordon has discussed today, because he has outlined very useful information, very useful approaches, some harder than others to come by, but in terms of getting your movie financed, and is leaving us today with some positive outlook about what we hope might expect, and we'll have to see how it all plays out, but in the domain of crowdfunding. And we're going to come back with Gordon soon. But thanks, Gordon. This has been fantastic. I want to also say that it's firemark.com is his website. It's at gfiremark, right? Is it Twitter address?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And it is. And then he's got offerings that he's made available to you, my listeners, at firemark.com/rec. So go and take advantage of that and check those out. And Gordon, thank you so much.
Rex, it's been a lot of fun. I'm really glad to have been here and enjoyed this talk.
Well, me too. I think you've helped really clarify and illuminate, and help us to understand the intricacies of these. And every time, you know, I rightfully so. Every time something is made clearer, it raises more questions and it creates more conversation and it allows us to look in more places. And you're an invaluable resource, and I appreciate you. Or I should invaluable and valuable resources. Make sure I say that correctly. priceless. But so thank you so much, and I'll talk to you in a few minutes, and have a great rest of the day.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you bet. Thank you. All right. Again, fascinating guest, chock full of useful and valuable information for filmmakers in terms of financing their film and making their projects happen. So I appreciate Gordon Firemark for being here today, and we'll have him back, as I said. And for you, my listeners, thank you for being here and listening as well. Thanks for showing your support, for being in the chat room when it's live, for spreading these interviews with your fellow filmmaker friends and industry contacts and friends around the world. Please do share them, tweet about it, put it on your Facebook wall, or post it in other forms. There's so many places out there that I don't even scratch the surface with where these interviews can go, but do share them. Share the podcasts, and remember, they're archived in their podcasts, and do leave comments. Don't go away without leaving a comment on today's show. Underneath the player, underneath the chat room, there's a comment window. It's available there. If you're listening archived and there is no chat, the comment window is there whenever you listen. Please leave a comment when you're listening to the show or afterwards, and because that helps us in so many ways. Gordon Firemark is on Facebook. Be sure to check him out on Facebook as well, as is Rex Sykes Movie Beat Friends on Facebook. So go and like Rex Sykes Movie Beat Friends on Facebook, And join us there. Get updates for the interviews and cast and crew information and movie projects. You can follow me on Twitter. It's Rex Sykes Movie BT. It's the last word is abbreviated, Rex Sykes Movie BT. Also, there's Rex Sykes Movie Beat, the YouTube channel. It's got some interviews of different celebrities and different little snippets and things up there that you might want to take a look at and enjoy. I appreciate you being here. Keep in mind, I got many more exciting guests coming up. Gordon will be back as well. And everybody have a fabulous day. Make your movies and complete your projects until we meet the next time. That is a wrap.